This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A flurry of TMT developments. Today, the governor asking for Mayor Harry Kim to reach common ground with the protesters. Big Island Judge Greg Nakamura denied a temporary restraining order this morning filed by opponents of the TMT project. It was a move to halt construction on the telescope over a security bond. And an Oahu judge is expected to decide on the governor's emergency declaration later today. Protests continue on Mauna Kea in opposition to the planned construction of the 30-meter telescope. Although TMT is the focus of activity, there are some 13 telescopes already operating on the mountain. As the protests heated up last week, managers of the Mauna Kea observatories made the decision to pull the workers off the mountain, and they haven't yet returned to the summit area. While he was on Hawaii Island last week, HBR's Ryan Finnerty spoke with Jessica Dempsey. She's the deputy director of the East Asian Observatory, which operates the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. She told us how the decision to withdraw the workers was made and how scientists are grappling with the debate raging around them.
I don't think you can prepare entirely for what we're seeing and experiencing now, but we, of course, knew that there was going to be a point where TMT was going to need to access the mountain. And so we were looking ahead to that, and with our staff and our planning, to recognize that it was going to be a challenging time for people getting up and down the mountain. We tried to plan our safety protocols to make sure that in as many scenarios as we could imagine, we had a safe environment at the summit facilities and in the travel to and from their homes for the staff that were going to have to be getting up there on a daily basis. So we talked that through. We made sure that our staff were looped in and communicated with about the potential for what could happen, and made sure that we were listening to them about their concerns, given that they are living here in this community, born and bred in this community, been here for some, decades, and that they understood that we knew how hard this was going to be for them, given this sort of challenges that were going to come ahead. So it was as much about making sure all of our staff were as comfortable as they could be and as prepared as they could be emotionally, as well as just the safety physically on the mountain.
We've seen firsthand how law enforcement officers have kind of dealt with that internal conflict. Mm-hmm. How have some of your workers, some of the people who go and work on the mountain, on the telescopes, what's it been like for them? Can you share some stories about how they've dealt with it?
I think it's been amazing. Our staff are incredible people, and they have family and friends, people that we interact with daily basis in all sorts of different ways, who have very strong feelings and rightfully so about what's going on the Mauna, and they're very torn, and so I think that everyone has conducted themselves, with an amazing amount of strength, and I think that we really recognize that this is incredibly difficult for a community, and so that all of our staff here have some people that they know who are standing on, in some ways, the other side, and I don't think that they feel like that. I think that they definitely understand and respect that, but also they want to go and do their jobs, and so we are trying to make sure that everyone is feeling heard, and that we understand how painful this can be for all of our staff who are here in the community and dealing with this.
Eventually, the decision was made to pull all the workers off the summit. Could you tell us a little bit about how that decision was made and maybe what you were hearing from those workers in the lead up to that decision?
Sure. And we had some staff who were either day crew who were at our halfway facility, Hale Pahaku, planning to do daily services. We've of course been optimistic that we could continue our regular observing during this. And it became clear that it was getting difficult to get our crews up and down on what we normally do, as there might not be a planned schedule for when we come up and down. And some of those staff had difficulty getting access through the access road. And while there was absolutely no bad experiences from the staff in what they were dealing with, we decided that this was going to get very, very difficult to plan and be consistent in how we normally do our operations if this was so uncertain on a daily basis. And secondly, law enforcement are just doing, you know, an incredible job. They've been so respectful. They worked so hard to try and ensure that we could do the things we needed. But we just decided to step to one side and not add an additional complication into what is already an incredibly complex and difficult situation. And that meant that we could ensure the safety of our staff and our facilities. And for the moment, just try and make something that is very complex at least slightly simpler.
In a lot of ways, it seems like the scientists and your workers are caught in the middle between this dispute between the demonstrators and the state, and by extension, the TMT organization, which is separate from all of the existing observatories. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
I think it certainly feels that way for a lot of our staff. You know, I'm very protective of our people, and I always just want them to not feel like they're stuck in the middle of this. I think what we're trying to do as a part of the community is find a way forward that is a future for everyone that is here in the community that does include astronomy on the Mauna, but also takes into account and really lifts up these other perspectives. And so I don't really feel like we are in the middle. I think we stand with our feet on the ground here in Hawaii, and we're looking up not just to the stars, but to a better future.
So where do things stand right now? There are no workers on the summit area working on the telescopes. How has that impacted operations for everyone?
It's very difficult not to be observing. And we do not have staff on the mountain at the moment, and at the moment we're maintaining that we will not be resuming normal operations until we have consistent access to the mountain. We're making that decision on a daily basis. So we also are, as I said, monitoring our critical systems very carefully. It's always a possibility that we will have one of our instruments in the telescope needing urgent care, which of course we hope does not happen, but it's something which we're definitely keeping an eye on.
What condition would have to be met for you to make the decision to start sending people back up the road?
We would just want to ensure that access for our staff is unimpeded, and we know that they would be able to get through on the road and do that safely. And so that will be what we'll be hoping for, and we'll hope for it, you know, as soon as possible.
From what I've seen, the demonstrators and their leadership say there is no danger for your workers to go up, that they wouldn't be harmed. So how are you making that assessment as to when it would be acceptable to start sending people back up?
When law enforcement essentially tells us that this road is unimpeded in every way, that'll be when we. So we're relying at this point on law enforcement to, you know, inform us that the road has unimpeded access for observatory staff to continue those operations.
And I don't want to make it about money, but I know that telescope time is worth tens of thousands of dollars a night. So as we enter a second week of a shutdown, how are the observatories being affected from a financial perspective?
So observatories do cost a lot of money to keep running. And that is true, whether or not we are, you know, collecting photons from the universe or not. And that is just part and parcel of running an observatory. And so it's a wrench to not be collecting the science. And at the end of the day, that is the part of it that I think especially our staff, who are so dedicated at making sure we squeeze every single minute of time up on the Mauna to get this amazing light from the universe. And so while, you know, the money part of it is always something which we consider when we're running these things, actually, I think the most sort of painful thing is that we can't, you know, do the science that we really are here to do and are passionate about. And the observatories are nonprofit organizations, and so we don't make money depending on whether we're open to the sky or not. All of when we say that a night is expensive, that's just simply because it costs money to run a facility, to pay our staff. And so that's when we say a night is expensive. It simply means, you know, these are complex and big behemoths, these observatories, and it takes money to run them.
We're not looking at any observatory having to potentially close or lay people off or anything like that as a result.
That's absolutely true. There's nothing in this that would mean that our observatories are suddenly in financial straits that would mean that our staff have to get laid off. They're our top priority.
What do you think this means for the future of astronomy in Hawaii? Because if I'm someone looking to build a telescope or to do this kind of science, and I see this happening, I'm probably going to go somewhere else, if at all possible.
I can't speak to future facilities and where they should be. I can speak to the amazing future for our existing observatories. Just bringing a new instrument into a facility can add a whole new window on the universe. And so I see the potential for a vibrant and long-term future, and amazing science and opportunities here in Hauai for the existing Mauna Kea observatories. And so that is the future that I'm looking towards and hoping we can find a path to.
When we were on the mountain, you said you believe science and cultural practice can coexist together on Mauna Kea. How do you envision that? How does that happen from your perspective?
One of my greatest hopes is that the next generation of people running our observatories are going to be locally trained and educated young people. I'd love that they're the ones that make the decision on what that future would look like. I think there is an incredible opportunity here for us to find a new path where all of these things not just coexist, because that still implies barriers, but instead we find synergies, because that combination is going to be so much greater than the sum of its parts. And so creating a space where we can have that conversation and find that way. I don't have the answer myself, but I really believe that generation, they will. So let's see what we can do to create the hope and the space for them to do that.
Do you think that science, either in general or specific to astronomy, has ignored cultural concerns in the past, or perhaps not ignored, but given them a lower priority than maybe what they deserved, and this is kind of a backlash to that?
I think that what I have learned in the 5 years since we really had these, the profile of this issue come so much more to light, is I've learned how to listen. And that has been so important in really starting to understand what we're having to deal with and experience. And so that listening is something which I think is really, really important for us here in every aspect, and certainly for the scientists and the observatory staff that are here. And that, for me, is the thing that I think has been most important.
And since you began listening in that way, what have you heard? What have you learned? Maybe has your mind on something changed, or were you exposed to something that you hadn't been before?
Just so many perspectives and so many stories, and their value is it's really important to me, and I want to keep listening. I'm just starting to really every time I have another conversation and I get another chance to hear stories, I recognize how important the conversation is, and how just opening up to letting in these stories is a part of this, and I really just hope I can continue to do it.
All right, Jessica Dempsey, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Jessica Dempsey is the deputy director of the East Asian Observatory, which operates the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope on Mauna Kea. You can find all our coverage of the TMT protests at hawaiipublicradio.org. And we continue to hear from you about this issue. Here are some community voices from our talkback line.
My name is Judith Burke, and I'm calling from Hilo, Hawaii. And I just wanted to say that I'm really disappointed in what I perceive as the one-sided coverage of the issue on Mauna Kea. I mean, it was like this whole long conversation with the AG, and then there was like this recorded comment from the opposition that really didn't even relate to the issue that you said was being discussed, which was the sound cannon. And I just really hope that at one time that you will take the time to really listen deeply to the other side as much as you'd listen deeply to the state. Thank you very much.
It would be interesting to know the history of when the first telescope was built and then the time frame from when the first telescope was built to the rest of the telescopes. And was there any activism on the part of the Hawaiians during that time that the telescopes were being built, trying to get them to not build the telescopes? Were they protesting back then? Some of the telescopes up there are due to be decommissioned. And have they started tearing them down yet? And maybe if those telescopes that were due to be decommissioned are being torn down or have been torn down, then that's something that should be in the favor of the activists in terms of letting the TMT telescope being built. Thank you.
This is Donna Bissimi calling from Honolulu. Just curious, the ancient Hawaiians were mariners and explorers. I would think they'd be really excited about the new telescope on Mauna Kea. Is there any way to make the telescope sacred so that both parties can agree? Thank you.
And thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line at 792-8217. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we explore the historic Kuaihau Church in downtown Honolulu. Known as the Westminster Abbey of Hawaii for its use, a location for coronating Hawaiian royalty, the stately place of worship was at one time the national church of the Hawaiian kingdom and the personal chapel of the royal family. It stands as one of the oldest sites of Christian worship in the islands and was commissioned during the regency of Kaʻumanu. Designed by prominent missionary Hiram Bingham in the neoclassical Mediterranean revival style of architecture, it was constructed of some 7 tons of coral rock quarried from off the coast of Oahu. The church was frequented by members of the Kamehameha and Kalakaua royal dynasties, and to this day, portions of services held there are given in Hawaiian, in Olelo Hawaii, which will come in handy for today's quiz. For our listeners, we ask you this: what does Kuaihau mean? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting Dancers of Damla Hamid, an indigenous dance company from British Columbia, 7 p.m. this Friday. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
This past Sunday, the congregation of Kauaiha'o Church gathered in a corner of its cemetery to properly thank community volunteers who came out to repair the damage done to 27 gravestones by vandals earlier this month. A visiting boys' choir from Arizona took part in the prayer service under the Norfolk Pines, and Kahu Kenneth Makuakani gave the blessing.
For those descendants who cannot have a voice because they haven't heard yet about this desecration that happened to their family members. So because of these men and their hearts for service to you, we say amen and glory to God in the highest. May their lives be enriched constantly and continually. May their businesses flourish, and may their ohana be glorified in every single way. And we thank you for their presence in our life. We thank you for their presence in our community. We thank you for their presence in all of creation. As we stand here as an ohana, as a community for each other, and may we be able to reach out like-mindedly when they need us.
Several dozen members of the Bricklayers Union offered their services, and other local businesses stepped up with equipment and supplies to help with the cemetery repairs. Mel Silva is a business manager of Local One, located in Kalihi. He told us that he felt it was the right thing to do.
I seen it at the news that the night before, but coming to work, I heard him on the radio again. And the Lord spoke to me, just to help these guys out. So I brought him to the boys' attention as soon as I got in the office. And then came out here in the morning to see if it was feasible, if we could do them, and look possible. So got in contact with Brickwood and the church, and then it was on. So that was it.
And I know the church community is very grateful because you folks not only did the work, but you did it fast.
Yeah, I did it quickly. You know, we all were glad we did them that quickly, but it's just because of the expertise of the men, you know, just everybody doing their part. It just went together so easily. It wasn't easy work. It's just because of the expertise of the union men that it went that quickly.
I mean, yeah, the gravestones are heavy.
Yeah. I think had some like 600-800 pounds. But everything just worked out from the beams at Hawaiian Dredging, bonded materials donated. We had Marmo helping out. It's just the whole community helping out each other. And then, like I said, all the praise go to God, but these men, all the volunteers from Local One deserve all the credit.
Yeah, and I know the community has been watching the strife that developed because of the EV in the church hall. And
yeah.
I know they're getting past that, but then to have this happen, the desecration was just kind of hurtful.
You know, the thing is, we never know how heartfelt this thing was, but towards the end of the day, some of the relatives came and they made us feel them. You know, you wouldn't think they were going through so much with this, but they were, and they, the gratitude that they gave us at the end of the day was worth everything. So, all good. You know, good to something wrong make them pono, yeah, so that now it's all pono again.
And we talked to Kahu Makuakani about the weekend healing service and the lingering controversy of the other Ibi Kapuna that the church is moving to resolve. Last fall, it announced it would work to resolve the lawsuit filed by some in the community over the unearthing of some 600 sets of remains of Ibi Kapuna. But the remains have not yet been reburied, partly because of legal red tape. Here is Kahu Makuakani about the healing process.
We had so much kokua, you know, so much help from the different unions that came in that had expertise, because the very next day when our church members came down, there were like four of us guys and we couldn't even lift the stone back up. I mean, that's how heavy, they're like 500 to 800 pounds, I guess. And so, you know, we're just laymen, we don't know how to do that. And out of the clear blue sky, that same morning, the Bricklayers Union representative came, Mel Silva, and he said, I want to help. And I got all my men, and we were going to Kokua to repair every single one. And they thought it was going to take maybe 3 days or more. And it actually took them 1 day because they had more men who came than they thought was going to. And so they got every one of these stones back up. And then they came the next day to finish up the remainder of the work. But it only took them the next morning. And like I said, it was community helping community for the good of community.
And there's only one headstone that will then have to be replaced because it's broken in pieces.
Yes. When that one went down, unfortunately, that was one of our oldest ones. And so that it just couldn't handle when it fell. So we're going to replace it to renew, but we're going to build another one. And then, so the Ohana from that grave site, we're really happy that we were going to take care of repairing their ancestors' grave.
And at the beginning of the service, you know, you asked for blessings upon the many hands that worked out here to repair the headstones. You asked for rest for the unrest at Mauna Kea, and also for all the hands that are working to bury our Iwi Kupuna. Talk about that healing.
Well, there's always healing that is necessary. We seem to, as human beings, I don't know why we do that, but we seem to find in 100 things that we have, there's 99 that we do correct or, you know, that's good, but we always pick on the one thing that's the difference or that rubs us the wrong way rather than the 99 that are good. And the healing is to remind us that we are really good people. And we come from all good families. And, you know, sometimes we make mistakes, but the mistakes are what makes us better. I mean, that is the success and failure are not two different things. Failure is part of what makes you successful in whatever way and that you justify success. Some monetarily, most of us is spiritually. And so the healing here spiritually is to say, I forgive you for what you've done, because I ask for forgiveness too, for I don't know what I did to you, but I am sorry if it did harm your heart, you know? And so spiritually, we have to ask for forgiveness. I mean, that is part of the process of Ho'oponopono, is to take us away from the animosity. Then there is no more fighting.
And it's been, what, I guess some 6 months now since the whole strife over the hall and the Iwi Kupuna, and you know, I guess maybe this is today's ceremony is maybe symbolic of the healing up above ground, and then also the spiritual healing that has to come from within the church community.
Well, there's always healing that's going to come from everywhere within our community as we find the same things that we believe in, rather than looking at what puts us apart, you know, those small little things. I mean, one of my Buddhist friends said, hey, we believe in 7 of the things of your 10 commandments. Can we get along? And, you know, and that made me think, wow, am I really, or not me, but, you know, are we as our faith community only looking at those 3 differences and saying, because of those, I'm not going to accept you as a human being? And I really believe that this is the time for change, and this is the time of healing, whether it's above ground, below ground, or even up in the sky. It's a universal healing of people kind, you know, of all creation. And part of what the Mauna Awakea is to remind us that we are not separate from the land, but as Kamehameha the third, you know, or even the fourth did, you know, when we were doing the Mahele of 1848, it said that when you buy the property, you buy the people, because that's an undivided, you know, we have an undivided interest. So the people are attached to the land. That is still our premise. It's not the land's attached to the people. We are attached to the aina. Because in Genesis 2:7, how did God create us? He took dust and he blew his heavenly ha into us. And that's how mankind came about. And so we are made from land.
And the community that came together to help restore the gravestones this month, some were members, some were not?
None of them are members. None of them are members. I mean, and maybe they, I don't know what kind of faith, or maybe lack of faith, but, you know, we can't say lack of faith. because they must have had faith in something, because it was an innate feeling that something was wrong to our people and our aina, and we have to come and take care of it. And so all of us as a community, we ma'alama each other. That's what I think community is and has always been about.
Okay, and then as far as timetable, can you share at all any information about the reinterment of the EV on property?
Well, I can't give you any information on that because I don't know the information on it. But
You're working on it.
You know, we've always been working on it. We are wrought with different laws coming against each, and when we try to do one, we're going against the law of another state agency. When we try to do that one, we are against. And so it's one of those kinds of scenarios that it's a lose-lose situation for us, so we have to take them inch by inch or even millimeter by millimeter. This is the first issue of its kind, and now that has shown the inconsistencies of the agencies as they cross-pollinate.
So we got to pray for that.
Okay. Then maybe we can make legislation so that we can have the same thing going on in every agency.
And Kahuma Kuakani says the two state agencies involved are the Health Department and the Department of Land and Natural Resources. DLNR's Historic Preservation Office and the Burial Council are specifically working through the process, but it does not appear to be a fast resolution.
Jazz musicians get maximum volume before the days of amplification? That's what drives the sound of Gypsy Jazz. Hear for yourself on Saturday, August 3rd, when Gypsy 808 plays HPR's Atherton Studio. The group combines Gypsy Jazz with blues and Hawaiian swing. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org, sponsored by Amoresco.
The Garden Isle is still recovering from last year's devastating floods, but today's reality check looks at what some community members have taken on to educate visitors to the island. This morning, we're reaching out to Honolulu Civil Beat's Alan Perichini. Good morning.
Hi, Catherine.
So tell us about this story you have.
Well, the recovery from the storms of April 2018 on the North Shore has been slow and slower than many people would have liked. And finally, the road was reopened last month, but there's some question about whether the road was really open or really ready to be open. And that's because there are three one-lane bridges that were being replaced. This really has nothing to do with the storms. It's two different projects. There was the storm damage that closed the road, but at the same time, they had to replace three one-lane bridges in order to replace yet another two one-lane bridges that fall after those. And that work is not yet complete. So the highway reopened from the storm damage, but you still can't drive in unimpeded fashion from one end of it to the other. And that has led to a great deal of concern among residents about whether the highway was reopened prematurely. And some of them sort of took the law into their own hands, almost a vigilante justice kind of approach, and decided to start stopping tourist cars, mostly obviously rental cars, that approached the area where the bridges are, and suggest to them that they turn around, or tell them that they weren't going to be able to park anywhere down the road, which isn't really true. And this has created a mess that may be worse than what it was trying to clean up. The Kauai Police Department, having initially sort of looked the other way when this started to happen over the 4th of July weekend, now says that these folks, if they do this again, would be subject to arrest or citation. So it's kind of a work in progress, and it's kind of a measure of community frustration that people would actually go out on the highway, tell cars to pull over, tell drivers that they aren't allowed to park where they are allowed to park. So it's an unfortunate situation, but it's one that, in typical Kauai fashion, has sprung up here.
Yeah, very curious. You know, you've got this rogue group that's doing this. Are they telling people, let's say, to park in areas so they will get ticketed?
No. Okay. They're telling them that the no parking zones probably are more extensive than they are. For example, at Lumahai Beach, parking is, as long as you pull your car completely off the road at Lumahai Beach, is legal. And the police have not been ticketing there if people are parking correctly. But the renegades, if you want to call them that, are trying to tell people that you can't park at Lumahai legally at all. And there are some other areas up there that are in the same situation. What this unfortunately conceals is that the real objective behind a lot of what was done on the road was to revise the way KA Beach and Hyena State Park operate, reduce the number of people who are allowed to go there by half or more than half every day, and create a shuttle system to get them there and back. So the And that it now requires reservations for parking at KA Beach and reservations to even walk into the park. And that's worked actually magnificently. The numbers of visitors at KA have declined enormously. The 900 per day maximum has not been exceeded. And that's related to the spirit of what the people who are active on the highway feel, that the entire area should be subject to those kinds of restrictions on access.
What does the Visitors Bureau have to say about all this?
The Visitors Bureau, having been silent for a while, has jumped into it in the sense that they are distributing a new flyer all over the island to car rental counters, concierge desks, any place visitors are likely to turn for information that explains what the situation is, what the status of the road is, where you can park, where you can't park, tells you that the parking fine as a result of a bill that went through the legislature last session or this session, sponsored by Representative Nadine Nakamura, increases the parking fines to $235, which is enough to get the attention of vacationers who previously, when the fine was just $35, would have just thought of it as a part of the cost of enjoying your day. But that now has changed, and the Visitors Bureau has, with a flyer and with some other activities they've been engaged in, is really trying to step up and make sure people understand what the situation is and what restrictions there are and what restrictions there aren't. It's sort of like a manifestation of the paranoia about over-tourism going to a new level.
Yeah.
Almost the pendulum swinging back in the other direction.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating situation that's developing there. Really appreciate your time, Alan.
Sure enough.
That was Kauai's Alan Parakini with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, I'm Lei from Aloha Gatsoul. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
For today's backyard quiz, we asked you the meaning behind the name of the iconic Kauaiha'o Church in Honolulu. A favorite place of worship among Hawaiian royalty, the church was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1966. Liliu Okalani directed the church choir here, and when she passed away in 1917, she was laid in state in its choral halls for a week of mourning. Kamehameha V and Kalakaua preferred it to other places of worship on the island, and to this day, the body of King Lunalilo rests in a crypt in the front courtyard. Eventually, the Cathedral Church of St. Andrews was built, supplanting Kauaiha'o as the center of royal worship in Hawaii. Today, the church is part of the United Church of Christ. In Olelo, Hawaii, the name Kauaiha'o translates to the waters of Ha'o because the site the church was built on was a freshwater pool in the care of High Priestess Ha'o. Well, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Coming Saturday, July 27th to HPR's Atherton Studio, it's The Elevations, a vintage soul band fronted by not one but three lead singers. Join us for an evening inspired by early Motown, R&B, gospel, and funk. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
There's another controversy tied to Kauai and flood recovery. The state championship canoe regatta is supposed to be held in Hanalei August 3rd, which is in just about 2 weeks. The Kauai Outrigger Association and the county said all 11 clubs on the island agreed the event should go as planned, even though some worry about the impact on the community in light of the flood recovery. We talked to some of the Oahu clubs who said they made a decision not to participate in light of community concerns about such a big contingent. We were at the regatta held at the Kaneohe Marine Corps Base, Hawaii, this month, where Colonel Raul Lianez welcomed the several thousand participants. It was a logistical challenge, pre-registering the vehicles and turning part of the tarmac near the marina in a place for canoes and club tents. But it's an event to strengthen community relationships. Some of the club members have military ties, and the clubs often lend their canoes for military personnel to race. Here's the
to host this regatta on the beautiful waters of Kaneohe Bay with the koalas in the background is a privilege for us to do this.
You know, one of the race officials, Maui Ola, recalled the start of the regatta here on the military base and tells us it was tied to a small carnival with just a handful of races decades ago.
Well, my mother and father, Margaret and Kenneth Oles, were friends with the commander of the base. And my uncle was E.K. Fernandez. And they had the idea of starting a carnival here on base and kicking it off with the canoe races. And so we held the first canoe races. Actually, we had it for several years. And it was here on the base. And we kicked off the carnival each year with the canoe races. So we had the carnival going on while we were racing. And then, of course, we could race and then go to the carnival.
Good fun.
Yeah, it was good fun. And I don't remember exactly when, but I think it was, I'm thinking it was in the late 50s or the very early 60s.
And then it's been kind of spotty.
Yes. We didn't have it here for several years, and I think even the carnival stopped for a while, but the carnival is back, and so are we. As you said, when RIMPAC is not here.
Yeah. But and so what is it that you love about being in this location?
Oh, I love the view. I think this is a very fair course, but I also just love to come out here. I've been taking a lot of pictures of the canoes with the mountains in the background because it's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's a nice break from Kehi.
It is. It's a very nice break from Kehi Lagoon.
Okay, hopefully we can come back again. Thanks so much.
You're more than welcome.
We also talked to the Outrigger Canoe Club about being at this particular venue and about the upcoming Kauai Championships. Here's Siana Austin-Hunt.
You know what, this is one of the fairest race courses on the island, and it's really a pleasure for us to be able to have access to it, and it's not something that we take lightly. That the Kona-Yohe Marine Corps opened up their base for us to be here is, it's a treat for us, it's a special place. And for a lot of us, we're just really excited to be here on the water and get the time on the water out there.
It is a fabulous venue. We're just looking out here over the Ko'olau's. I know one of the things that's hanging over the races is the regatta that's scheduled for the championships over on Kauai next month. And I understand that there are some canoe clubs that aren't going, and you're one of them. Can you explain why?
Yeah, you know, we just really came together as a club and wanted to make a decision that was appropriate for not only hearing what the needs of that community were, but also representing as a one big canoe club community, how we could best be a support to them. And at this time, it didn't seem that this was the best feasible opportunity for us to take 500 plus paddlers and their families over there. And we just wanted to be able to give that community a little bit more time to heal and be prepared for as many paddlers as come along with this state's race.
Okay, so then basically it's up to each canoe club to decide whether they're in or they're out.
That's right. So as far as Okra was concerned, in our association, each canoe club made the decision independently. We went over into that community, we spoke to people, we really wanted to hear what their heart for, their timing of a good state's race for them would be, and we wanted to honor what their requests were, and at this time we didn't feel that that was the best time for us to show up with as many people as we represent as outward. So it was our independent decision, and our hearts are there with that community. We support them. Many of them are members of our club. We know them. We are, you know, we really want to make sure that they know we are behind them 100%, and we fully intend to support them going forward. And just giving them a little bit more time to heal is really what this decision is about.
We also talked with Hui Nala's Bruce Blankenfeld, who hosted the John D. Kaupeka Memorial Regatta, about the club decision not to go to Kauai this year.
You know, that community got hit very hard, you know, a year ago. And they're still, they're just at the stage where they're, you know, everything's getting good. But, you know, talking to community early on, we were surprised that they were going to hold the race there this year. We were hoping that they would find another venue, like maybe here in Honolulu, and then go back next year. Instead of just kind of rush into it and try to fix it up, okay, we're ready to go. You know, because the community, I think, is split. I don't know where the, you know, how big the split is. Some say, you know, we're not ready. Some say, oh, we're more than ready, you know. But from our viewpoint, from a value-based, it's about Malama. You know, knowing that, you know, hearing from the community over there that they don't think, you know, they'd rather, I mean, what we kept hearing, they'd rather we come next year.
Well, Coach?
That was a statement. And anyway, so planning-wise, it's a big effort. You know, flights for everyone, and you got to get the kids there early on the first flight, or they ain't going to even make it to the race. And so that was becoming a tough one, just planning on that.
So you're deferring to the community.
So we're deferring to the community. I talked to a bunch of friends there that sailed with us in Hokulea, and they're good people, and they're honest people, and they just said, you know what? They tried to see it from the viewpoint of making it work, but they just said, you know, maybe, probably next year.
Right. So you're going to sit this one out.
So we decided to just, because we had like, we would be going in there with about 500 paddlers. You know, in the end, you know, as a board, you know, we just have to make a decision. You know, canoe race or honor a community. You know.
So that's what's driving your decision.
Yeah.
And then I heard maybe Outrigger 2 is not going either.
Outrigger is also, yeah.
And anybody else? I don't know.
You know, I heard Yaya Kahoy wasn't going, and Yelani wasn't going, Yurikai. I mean, I'm just hearing this, so I'm not.
Yeah, you don't know if it's official, but folks are starting to rethink, is this appropriate?
Race officials declined to comment about the club's pulling out until after it had a chance to talk to its parent group about the turn of events this weekend. Thank you. That's it for today. Tomorrow we look at the forecast for our coral reefs as we start to get into the hottest months of the year. Tell us what's on your mind, call or talk back line, or leave a comment. The number to do that, call 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.